Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
You know, to get the Bulls to leave the arena, it's a lot like dealing with a 15-year-old boy that's got a bunch of girls around him. You know, you can say whatever you want, but he's not paying attention to you. And so sometimes you've got to go out there and you've got to actually act as bait.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. And this is J.J. Harrison. He lives in Walla Walla, and he's one of the region's more famous rodeo clowns.
You need to kind of let the bull think he's going to run you over. And then what you do is you use your amazing Okanagan High School athletic ability, and you run to the outgate, and the bull will chase you into the outgate, and he'll leave, and you jump up on the fence and look like the star. So I'm in Hobbs, New Mexico, and the bullfighters are struggling to get a bull out. So I went out, and I got a bull's attention. I ran, and I almost got him to the outgate, and the son of a gun turned off. So I went out, and I got a little too close to this bull. And as I was leading him out, as I turned to run, I stepped down into a horse footprint and fell down. Now, when you fall down directly in front of a charging 2,000-pound bull, there's a lot that goes through your head. Everything seemed to slow down. I just remember thinking, this could be the end. I thought, he's obviously going to run me over. There's no way I can stop this bull. So I rolled to my back, and that's about all the time I had. And I put my arm up, and I for some reason thought I was going to have some kind of Marvel strength and be able to just put my arm up and stop him. I do not have that strength. He ran right through me. I got a massive contusion in my arm. He stepped on my foot and broke it. We went knee to knee, fractured my kneecap. But he didn't hit my head. I hit my head. So I put my arm up. He hit my arm. I punched myself in the face. The advantage that I had was that the bull had so much speed built up that he couldn't get stopped to really stick me with a horn, because I don't wear pads. So if a bull steps on me, I'm lights out. It's over. And it made me think just how much, you know, I really need to be careful in my job. I sprung right back up. And of course, every medic wanted to talk to me, but I knew the bull riding still had to keep going. We had about six more bulls. And I knew the second that I shut down, the second that I stopped, they were going to pull me. They were going to take me out. So I ignored them. I pretended I couldn't hear them yelling at me. And I just stayed out there and kind of made jokes about getting run over, made fun of myself. Again, that self-deprecating humor. And so I left the arena. Everybody felt like I was fine. I don't want somebody seeing me get hurt. I don't want a kid watching me. Everybody wants to see the clown get run over until I get run over. Into the bull riding, I kind of slunked off. They forgot about me a little bit, and I crawled up on top of these speakers. Anyway, the next thing I remember, they were lifting me off of these speakers. I had, you know, I'd passed out. And, you know, the thing about my job and the thing about, you know, rodeo in general is I had a flight out of Albuquerque at 7 o'clock in the morning. It was a five-hour drive from Hobbs. So I finished that. They woke me up. I said, thank you. I got my check, and I drove 5 hours to get to the airport because I got to keep going. If we get injured, there's no check that comes in the mail. If we get injured, there's nobody that says, hey, we're going to take care of you for a couple weekends. So my income, my life is based on my ability to work. So when I broke my back up in Canada, I did it on a Sunday. I had a bull hit me, threw me about 12 feet in the air, stomped on me. I braced it up and did a rodeo Thursday in OMAC.
Today on our show, our theme is bouncing back, stories of people who take the hits and come right back for more. Our rodeo clown, J.J. Harrison, wasn't exactly born into this line of work. He comes from a family of teachers and lawyers. He did grow up loving rodeo, though, and tried his hand at some of the classic events. Still, as he was finishing college, he was headed squarely for a straight job. He told us how his clowning career unfolded and why, in spite of the punishment he takes, he keeps bouncing back.
When I graduated from college, I had a pretty serious girlfriend in college, and it was kind of that, okay, now we have to grow up. So I hauled my horses with me, and I still roped a little bit, but I really did shut the door on rodeo. And I wanted to throw myself into whatever I was doing with all of my heart, and that was going to be a school teacher. And I just dove full, just head first, right on into teaching. And here's me in a nutshell. I would get every kid to come in and do SSR, which stands for silent sustained reading. They would come in and we'd try to get the kids calmed down. I'd get them all deathly quiet. They'd be reading their books. I would stand on top of my desk and drop a dictionary, and it'd be sound like a bomb going off and scare every kid to death. I just giggle about that. And I kept them on their toes. And so what I would try to do was educate by using some entertainment. I think as human beings, we don't know what our passions are until later in life. We don't know because we just try so many things. We just do so many different things. And then all of a sudden, there'll be an itch. Something will just keep bugging at you. This is who I want to be. It's a feeling that burns deep down inside you. And I think cowboy always came back to what I wanted to do. But I am a screwball. So it kind of reared its head on a Halloween joke. I dressed as a rodeo clown for Halloween. And a friend of mine, a coworker, her daughter was married to a stock contracting buddy. And so they mentioned it to him. And he called me and said, hey, have you ever thought about being a rodeo clown? And I thought, don't those guys wear makeup? And yeah, they do. No, thank you. I'm not going to wear makeup. That's ridiculous, The more I thought about it, I said, all right, I'll give it a whirl. I'll do it. All you do is come up with three stupid things. And, I'd been to enough rodeos. I'd watched enough rodeo clowns. But I wanted to just be myself, just be goofy. And, of course, the first one I ever did, I was the opposite of that. I had these three drawn-out acts, and I was trying so hard to have a dog that shrunk down into a smaller dog and all the corny stuff. Every corny rodeo clown thing you can think of, I was trying to do it. And they would all fall apart. And what made the crowd appreciate me was my ad lib. For me, it was just fun. In 2008, I was getting big rodeos were calling me. And a guy named Glenn Miller from Sisters, Oregon, called me and he offered me the rodeo down there. And I said, I'd love to, but it's the last weekend of school and I can't do it. I'm a school teacher. And he said, I'm going to tell you something. We'll call you once. We don't usually call back when we hear no. And so that really resonated with me, was that, if I want to do this, now is my opportunity. Now is the time. And so I told myself that if I could make my teaching salary in my 2.5 months of summer rodeoing, that I would feel comfortable to step away from education and I'd be able to equal what I made teaching school. Our main product is the rodeo. It's the bareback riding, the bronc riding, the tie down rope, and the bulldogging. And of course our, frosting on the cupcake is the bull riding. Everybody kind of knows bull riding or has heard of it. My job in this whole little escapade is to fill the lulls. And It's crazy though how much of the main show I can really be if I want. And I've done this. I can take over a rodeo. I can give the crowd so much of JJ that that's all they remember. Because I'm not out there just for 8 seconds. I'm not out there just for a short amount of time. They see me for 2.5-3 hours. So, they can relate to me. They feel like at the end of the rodeo they know me a little bit. My job in the bull riding is to be the guy that gets hit. In that barrel is the idea. It's a custom built barrel. So inside of it, mine's made out of aluminum. It's probably about 5 feet tall. You jump up, get down into it. It's got padding. My new one's got about 6-inch padding inside it. And people will always ask, what does it feel like to get hit by a bull? It feels exactly like getting hit by a Dodge truck. You might not break anything, but you're darn sure going to feel it, and you're darn sure going to hurt yourself. And I've had bulls do funny things. In Sisters, Oregon, I had a bull hit me and knock me clear out of the arena. It hit me, and I was rolling across the arena. And then the funny, what was great was the bull stopped, and then he rolled me right into the out gate. They just closed the gate, and everybody said, go! You know, I've had numerous close calls where bucking horses will run right past me. You know, I've been knocked down by rodeo queens. I've been knocked unconscious. So you're constantly trying to keep your head on a swivel. And then you're trying to have longevity in your career. You know, that's the thing. The new guys that will come out, they've got this rodeo, rough, tough cowboy, I'm a man. You know, that in that kind of mindset, those guys aren't going to last very long. The guys that are going to last a lot longer are the ones who see this as a business. They see this as their career. They're going to take the risk, but it's going to be calculated. If I'm going to get in that barrel and I'm going to pack that barrel in, it's because I'm going to save a cowboy or I'm going to protect one of my bullfighters. I'm not going to do it just to go in there so I can get hit and everybody thinks I'm tough. You know, that's cost me some things. That's cost me some ridicule from some other rodeo clowns. And you know, I just generally, when I take grief like that from another rodeo clown, it's because they're sitting at the couch at their house while I'm working. So it doesn't bother me too much. I love the crowd. When people ask me, what's your favorite part of your job? It's the crowd. Every single time. Doesn't matter if I'm in Stonyford, California, or if I'm in Kissimmee, Florida, or if I'm in Hilo, Hawaii, or Denver, Colorado. It doesn't matter. Every crowd member is the exact same, because you're going to have somebody who's never been to a rodeo and somebody who's been to 70 rodeos. And if you can win both of those people over, I feel like that drives me to keep coming back. And I've done this job long enough now that I'm starting to get the stories of how I really inspired people, how I've really changed somebody's life, how I really brought them through a low time. And just with my comedy, just with my, you know, I had a guy that was going through a divorce. I didn't know him. I don't know him at all. I came to the trailer, visited with him for 15, 20 minutes. And he sent me a message. He was contemplating suicide. And it just my zest for life brought him out of a dark place. I mean, I teared up. You know, I teared up when I read that on Facebook, of all things. He sent this to me. And, you know, so those moments keep somebody like me driving and keep somebody like me inspired, but they also keep me very humble that I have this great life, this great wife, this great kids, great family, great house. But rodeo gave all of this to me. The entertainment industry gave me all of this, but it could take it all away just like that. So you got to be mindful of it.
J.J. Harrison lives in Walla Walla. You can see a picture of him being squashed by a bull at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and today we're telling stories of bouncing back. In 2018, Seattleite Chris Jekyll was reeling from a breakup. It was amicable, they just didn't work out. But still, when you're suddenly alone after many years as a couple, it can be disorienting.
You're left with a hole. And I was in that hole.
Chris decided it was the right time for a trip. It was kind of a bold idea, for reasons that'll become clear shortly. One thing he did know was where he wanted to go.
Friends had told me forever, you know, that Tokyo and Japan in general was a place that you could go and ride the trains and you could, you know, eat the food and enjoy the people. And so it just seemed like a really great place to go and just kind of shake things up.
So what makes planning a trip abroad for you different than it might be for any other schmo on the street?
So I have a visual impairment. I can't see that well. I don't see out of my right eye at all, really. And in my left eye, I have a blurry center line of vision.
So you're legally blind.
Yeah, legally blind. There's a million titles: low vision, legally blind, visually impaired. I can't even keep track of them. And, you know, I think about, is there transportation? Like, am I going to be able to get around? You know, like taxi cabs. Like, I was Googling, like, okay, like, how easy is it for me to hail a taxi in Japan? It turned out to be pretty doable. I think about trains. Like, how easy is it for me to get on the trains? And I would say, too, like, if I go to a place, is it going to be stimulating to me? And I rely a lot on sensory experiences. So, you know, when I think about Tokyo, and Tokyo was the main draw for me in Japan, I think about art and fashion and lights. And even though I can't appreciate it in the same way that you might, because your vision is better, I can still interpret it in a way that I can appreciate it.
So after a very long day of travel to get there, and then you get yourself to bed eventually.
Yes.
What was it like to wake up in this, you know, on the other side of the world?
I just wanted to go out and do it. I wanted to go to the fish market. I wanted to go to some of the shrines. I wanted to go to Shibuya, where they have the busiest intersection with foot traffic.
Is that one you see in the movies where it's like a bunch of streets coming together
and people just go across in flocks? And what's awesome too is so when people in Japan cross the street, there's so many people that it's like...
It's like a slime mold.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. I would like fight my way into the middle of the mob, and then I would know when it was time to cross the street because we'd all walk together.
Tell me a little bit more about the sensory experience of being there. What did it smell like and sound like and things like that?
Yeah, it's a very bright city. You know, when you're walking down those main thoroughfares in the Shinjuku district, entire facades are covered with bright, beaming lights. Storefronts are flashing neon. There are light fixtures near intersections that are twinkling. It was like a dream sequence.
If your sort of field of vision is small and blurry,
yeah,
to have a completely different flavor of visual experience must be kind of cool.
Yeah, it was. I was just transfixed, man. I just remember staring at everything and just oceans of people. And the energy was amazing. And one day I went to the, I'm probably not pronouncing this correctly, but the Takeshita Fashion District. And then I just kept going for like an hour and a half. And I just walked. And eventually I came to kind of this quieter residential area. And there were bicycles coming and going, and I knew because I could hear the bells. A motor would purr by, and you know, it's late afternoon, so there's kids kind of goofing around, messing around on the sidewalk or the street, and people are coming home, getting bags out of cars. I know this because I can hear them grabbing stuff as they're shutting car doors, and they're walking up steps, and out of nowhere, this calming peace came over me. And I thought about it a few days later. I mean, I couldn't put words on it at the time, but a few days later, I really gave it some thought. And I thought, stepping outside of my world, my issues, my experience, you know, living in the US, Seattle, I think being able to step outside of that and witness a slice of life completely out of my world made me feel really small in the best kind of way.
So suddenly the things that are bothering you or weighing you down don't feel so large.
No, it made me really happy to see people just living their lives on another continent with their own problems, by the way, but living.
So this trip, sort of born of heartbreak and the desire to, as you said, sort of like rediscover who you are and where you end and other things begin. How did it go in those terms?
The flight back to Seattle from Tokyo is about 11, 12 hours. And so you get time to think and sort of pick things apart, connect dots. And for me, it was the joy of feeling truly electrified by something. I don't want to sound too new agey here, but I think every city has a spirit. You know, Seattle has a spirit. Chicago has a spirit. Tokyo definitely has a spirit. And to be able to really open yourself up to accept it and plug into it is really exciting. And when I got home, and I don't know if this was like at SeaTac or when I walked through my dorm, I don't remember the moment, but I do remember thinking, I'm gonna be okay.
Chris Jekyll lives in Seattle. This is Sound Effect, Gabriel Spitzer here, and today our theme is bouncing back. It's kind of the nature of despair that when you're in its depths, it's hard to even imagine lifting yourself out. But that's something that Cherie Cooks has figured out how to do. Cherie's a working mom with three kids in Tacoma. She gives talks to school administrators about race and equity, and she co-founded a nonprofit called Eastside Community Action Network. But Cherie says none of this would have been possible if not for some very, very tough breaks. She talked with Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing.
Cherie Cooks is a 37-year-old African-American woman who has a deep love for Tacoma's East Side, a low-income part of town that is on the upswing but still struggles with crime. On a sunny afternoon, Cherie takes me on a walk through Swan Creek Park. Improving the health of people in this neighborhood is part of the mission of Cherie's nonprofit. She's hoping to lead three walks in Swan Creek Park this year.
So I've always gone outdoors on trails with my kids. We used to live closer to the trail on the other side. And you just didn't see many people on the trails. And I wanted to expose more people to, like, look at this beautiful space that's in our area. And a lot of folks did not know it was back here.
13 years ago, Cherie could not have imagined herself being so active in the community. Back in 2006, Cherie's life was good. She was a teacher in a daycare. Most of the parents worked at Tacoma General Hospital.
And we had the motto that you always got a baby in your arms. So if I'm not changing someone's diaper or feeding someone, I'm holding someone else. I'm playing with another baby. And I loved it. I loved going to work.
Cherie was a single mom, raising two daughters, Deja and Daylin. They were able to come to work with her. Daylin, her youngest, was walking by 9 months, and by 14 months, she was a curious, talkative toddler. But by the time Daylin was 2 years old, something was off.
I started to notice that her energy level was down. You know, toddlers are pretty busy, but she would get tired pretty quickly. And then it kind of progressed to where she didn't want to walk.
Cherie got an appointment with a pediatric neurologist, and Daylin got an MRI.
They called me the next morning, like 5 a.m., and they said, pack your bags. You need to go to Seattle Children's Hospital. This is what we found.
The MRI revealed a tumor.
It was pretty large because they classified her stage 4. And it was large enough, and it was wrapped around her spine.
Life for the family changed overnight. Cherie had to quit the job she loved. The kid's paternal grandmother cared for Daylin's older sister, while Cherie and Daylin settled into their new home, a room at Seattle Children's Hospital. This is where Daylin and Cherie spent a better part of 2.5 years. Cherie came to rely on the hospital's many volunteers who helped entertain Daylin and who gave Cherie small breaks to step outside for a bit. This help got Cherie thinking about how she would live her life a little differently once this was all over. But it wasn't over yet. Daylin responded to chemotherapy, but the stress of everything really got to Cherie.
I think I hit my bottom when I got pregnant with their father. I was lonely, you know, just one of those things.
Before all of this, Cherie and the girl's father had tried to make a go of being a couple, but it didn't work out. He was in his kids' lives, but he and Cherie, they weren't together anymore.
And then there was a nurse that was just such a sweetheart. And I was telling her what happened and that I was pregnant and that I was ashamed that I didn't want him, just because I was so focused on the life that I was dealing with. And she told me, she said, this can be a gift because this will give your daughter a younger sibling, someone, you know, that she could help take care of and be excited about. And also, medical-wise, when you have your baby, they are able to take stem cells from the umbilical cord to store away that could be used to treat major illnesses. When my son was born, Dayon, he, so cute, first off. When he came along, he was a gift. Daylin loved her brother. I had to stop her from wanting to give him shots. Like, no, this is a real baby. You gotta play with your other baby. And it did bring more joy than I thought it would.
Daylin continued to do well. Her tumor disappeared. She was able to build up her muscles and to walk again. Life slowly started to come back into focus. Cherie went back to work in childcare, and with the help of the kid's grandmother, Cherie started to take some time for herself. She met a great guy. They're now going on 10 years together. And with all of this backup and support, Cherie says that she was able to think about how she could begin to give back to her community.
I went to volunteer at Mary Bridge Hospital. I was thinking back about the volunteers that supported me and helped me and how well, how good they made me feel. And I worked in the surgical unit and I got to do some of the same things by bringing kiddos toys and talking to them and reading them books.
Then Cherie started to volunteer in her children's school, Sheridan Elementary.
Our area is all, it is a lower socioeconomic area where, you know, a lot of families are working class families that don't necessarily have the time to show up physically, but doesn't mean that they care any less about their children's education. So I was going with that stance that I'm going to classrooms for all of them, not just my own child.
Eventually, Cherie became the president of the Tacoma Council. This is the organization that oversees all of the parent-teacher associations in the Tacoma School District. She started to give workshops to school administrators and principals about how to talk about race with students, and she shared her experience of being a mom of a Black son.
The stereotypes or biases around young Black children that if they're misbehaving or acting out of class, it must be because they have a hard life at home. You know, another assumption that was made about my child when it was like, I actually do work in this district. I've got a great partner. We've got a pretty stable household. You know, that's not an issue. He's just a growing 7-year-old boy.
Nothing will change if we don't do right by our kids. This is at the core of everything Cherie does, including her day job of running an after-school program through the Peace Community Center in Tacoma's Hilltop neighborhood. She keeps going and doing, except for the days when her body forces her to stop.
2 years ago, I woke up and I had a bunch of paramedics looking down at me. And I was like, what is going on? And my partner's on the side and I'm in the bed and he's like, baby, you just had a seizure. And I'm just like, what?
The seizures were sporadic, but a few months ago, they started to pick up. Cherie had one as she was driving her kids on I-5. They had an accident, but Cherie's oldest daughter, Deja, acted really fast and took the wheel from her mom and slammed on the brakes. The car was a loss, but no one was seriously hurt. It could have been so much worse. Cherie got a formal diagnosis of epilepsy. Today, she gets around by Lyft, public transit, and rides from friends. One of her more recent seizures happened when she was at the Tacoma Symphony before the performance started.
And I remember my friend saying, you need to call Preston, that's my partner. You got to go home. You just had a seizure. And I just start crying. I don't want to go home. I said, I don't want to go home. I want to stay. I want to stay. And she was like, okay, if the paramedics say you're okay, then you can stay.
Having a seizure takes a lot out of a person physically. And in this situation, most of us would have headed right for the door. Not Cherie. She stayed to hear the music.
Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing brought us that story. Cherie Cooks lives in Tacoma. You can learn about her next guided walk at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Bouncing Back. Crystal Marks is a city council member in Burien. Her husband James is an Iraq War veteran. They've both experienced hardships that have never fully left them. In her case, it was poverty and homelessness as a kid. For him, it was combat-related PTSD. Their relationship and their healing began on rival superhero teams. These are people, often in full costume, who walk the streets helping the helpless, fighting crime, you know, hero stuff. So this is a story set against the real-life superhero movement in Seattle. And it's a love story.
I had heard about this group called the Rain City Superhero Movement, led by some dude that went by Phoenix Jones.
I had heard a couple of radio interviews with Phoenix Jones back when he was actively patrolling Belltown and Pioneer Square and breaking up bar fights and things like that. And I started walking around at night hoping to find him just to see what it looked like. The idea of someone who really dressed that way, who really broke up fights, like a comic book come to life, was really amazing to me.
I just thought it was a bunch of Comic-Con nerds dressed up playing superhero.
I love superheroes. Wonder Woman was huge. She-Ra was my jam when I was a kid.
I remember reaching out to a buddy of mine and saying, hey, let's go check out some nerds. And we actually went up to, you know, let's go check these guys out.
Learning about the real-life superhero movement made me feel like there were people that were just as nerdy as me. But it also spoke to that side of me that's always been about empowering others, that's always been about finding solutions instead of constantly complaining.
I was very delightfully surprised I actually met with all of them. Immediately, this seemed to fill a lot of those holes I had. Being able to use small squad tactics, we would patrol the city like a kind of a glorified block watch thing. We would break up fights. We'd make sure drunk people fiddling for their keys would get thrown in a cab.
I found the Washington Initiative. They were focused primarily on homeless outreach, not so much on the breaking up bar fights, and they didn't dress up.
I was the big dude with a silver and blue helmet. It was actually inspired from a video game. It was on sale at an airsoft store. I'm like, hey, you'll do. And that kind of became a known moniker as, that guy was like Spider-Man, or that other guy was this. And I was the guy that, he looks like Daft Punk or Megatron.
We would make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, grab water bottles, tarps, and then we would head down from Steinbrück Park and go from the north end of the viaduct there all the way down to about Marion, Madison area and just do handouts.
I remember watching on a previous patrol sometime back, this sweet old lady who appeared to be homeless was being harassed by a bunch of club goers on their way out to their vehicles. And they're very rude, and they hopped in the cars and left very quickly. But I remember we were like, hey, are you okay? Do you need anything and stuff? And I remember seeing her a couple months later. You may not remember me, and you know, that's totally fine. But I just want to say, you know, I hope you're doing well. I know there were some people that were very, you know, unkind to you and said a lot of nasty things as they went out. And there are good people out here. Just, you know, take care of yourself, okay? And she said to me, I love you too. That stuck with me forever, and it still does to this day. That really summed up what we were doing in very weird, flamboyant ways with our, you know, all superhero personas, all stuff. We're loving our community. I became aware of Crystal as her superhero persona because, sure enough, she was doing the same kind of work on a competing team.
everyone was always aware of each other. So the Rain City Superheroes, the Phoenix Jones crew, and then the Washington Initiative, we were the only two in Seattle. And there was a big, it sounds so corny and pathetic to say, but like a superhero battle where we're doing homeless outreach the right way, you're doing it the wrong way. And well, we're fighting crime the right way and you're doing it the wrong way. Late 2013, early 2014, we were forbidden to interact with each other.
I remember being invited to a needle pickup event, and I had to actually tear off my RCSM badge, which is on the back of my jacket, because I didn't want, you know, I can't have anyone knowing that the RCSM is colluding.
And unfortunately, that didn't work well when James, my husband now, reached out to me on Facebook and said, you know what, we're doing the same stuff.
We can maybe pair up on this sometime, and maybe we can make this a joint effort and everyone can learn a thing.
And we decided to meet for coffee and talk about ways that we can do it better. And both of us were terrified that the other person had teammates hiding at Top Pot Donuts in Belltown waiting to take us down on the way out, and both overly paranoid.
I remember having my head on a swivel. So I remember going to the upstairs of the Top Pot and just kind of sitting there waiting. And
he ordered a maple bar and hot chocolate, which I thought was lame because coffee is way better. And he's a large guy. He's an Army combat veteran who is broader than three barns and about 6'2". So seeing him in person, I was like, well, this is a nice looking man.
Holy crap, she's tall.
We sat across from each other on the top floor of Top Pot and just had a frank conversation about why we thought our teams weren't getting along. He really liked how my brain was very focused on logistics. And I liked that even though his team was seen as kind of like the premier real life superhero team and they were really all about show, he had a huge heart for people. And that's the questions he asked me, was about, why do you do this work? What do you like about it? And that really got me to let my guard down a lot.
I don't think I can quite put into words how trivial and juvenile the superhero community can be. I mean, you know, we're talking about a bunch of grown adults that put on costumes of sorts. I mean, this draws a very particular kind of crazy. So Crystal truly stood out to me as a natural born leader, had wonderful ideas for a community, had endless energy for being able to help people and put together events and plan things.
We had met up for a very easy patrol and walk around of Cap Hill. I was very keenly aware of how close our hands were when we were walking, and they would bump into each other. And
I remember bumping into her a couple times, just kind of inadvertently, you know, partially because, you know, it's dark, all that stuff, and I'm also wearing a big stupid helmet that doesn't have great visibility. And more than once, our hands brushed. It was like a spark leapt out.
I realized, like, he knows his stuff. He's very smart. He's asking how my kids are. I think I love this guy. And by the time we got near Gay City, neither one of us wanted to stop walking. So we went up Bellevue Avenue, and there was a house there. We were standing outside of there and like, hey, how much do you think this house is worth? And we're getting closer and closer. And at some point we're bickering, and the next thing you know, we're kissing. Phoenix Jones, as the leader of the RCSM, said that our relationship was a big thing. They had a rule: you do not date members of the initiative. And James, as his second in command, that was just unheard of. Why would you do that? You're insubordinate. That was a big part of it.
It was during media, I think 2015. It was poorly planned, very poorly executed. We got put in danger's way countless times.
Every May Day, Phoenix Jones has his team and the initiative has our team. But essentially, we all interacted too much, and that scared Phoenix Jones, thinking that he was losing his leadership.
He wouldn't have it.
And the teams broke up.
So, well, you know what? I started this group so I can end it. So I am officially hereby disbanding the RCSM, and everyone goodbye.
In September-ish of 2014, by then we are very actively dating. I've met his family. He's met members of my family. Our kids adore each other.
Our kids just meshed immediately. And watching how she parented her boys too was absolutely remarkable to me. She's a wonderful, strong mother that really boosts her children.
and he proposed on January 1st of 2015 at Snoqualmie Falls.
We found this charming little house in Burien. Ironically, the same place I'd spent a whole childhood trying to get away from. It was one of the last places we could afford. By the time we got married, which was while we're still at that house, we got married there in that front lawn underneath a willow tree.
He's got the biggest heart of anyone I've ever seen. He will cry at the drop of a hat over someone's story and sharing their experiences. And then he's also a huge, just huggable dad. He's our kids' playground. They will swing off of him, climb off of him, and he loves it. He was born to be a dad as much as he was born to be a soldier and will always be a soldier, as much as he was born to protect his community and born to empower me. He just loves, and he loves so deeply that my only worry for him is that he doesn't know how to stop.
In addition to our regular lives, we always try to do a little bit extra for our community, and that's kind of something that we are using as examples to, you know, show our kids, you know, this is how you adult. This is how you love on your community. And, you know, our kids are at that age where, you know, they're very, very impressionable. And they're very, you know, they need those good role models. And Crystal and I both try to be that for all of our kids.
My kids have talked about becoming superheroes since the first moment they heard of us doing it. And it's morphed into them noticing when we pass by a homeless encampment and saying, you know, Mom, how would you be a superhero in this? Or here's what I would do. I want to give them our TV. And from a kid place, that's the biggest thing they could possibly give. So if my kids wanted to get into the real life superhero movement, I would say go for it. Maybe don't wear the costumes.
James and Crystal Marks live in Burien. We reached out to Phoenix Jones for his side of the story, but did not hear back. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we've been talking about bouncing back today. We'll close the show with the story of Christy Abram. Christy grew up with more challenges than any teenager should have to confront, and she faced them alone. Talking about her problems did not seem like an option. Well, that began to change when she started writing, and now she's looking to help other young women of color discover that too. We get the story from KNKX's Ariel Van Cleve.
The first thing you need to know about Christy Abram is she's a hugger. When you see her smile and hear her warm laugh, you just give into the embrace. Another thing you should know, this woman is present in your conversation. It's important for her that you feel heard because that wasn't the case for her for the longest time, especially when she was a teenager.
By 17, I had a son, and my mother was an alcoholic, and I was passed around a lot, probably from the age of 11.
And that family she was passed along to, they were also on drugs. All of it was just unstable, and she felt like a burden.
I spent a lot of time in everybody's house and just trying to find like my groove, like where do I fit?
By the time she was 16, she realized she wasn't really finding her groove at all. So she emancipated, moved out on her own, and got ready for the birth of her son. This wasn't an easy time. Writing had become key to her survival. Christy would write in journals, or honestly, any scrap of paper would do fine. It made her feel safe, but she couldn't tell anyone she was doing this. She knew her family and friends wouldn't get it.
In, you know, African-American culture, it's just kind of like you don't tell people your business. It's like you just kind of, you know, it's this whole strong woman kind of like, you know, ideal. Like we just have to always show up. And so I was doing my best even at that time and emulating some behaviors that I thought were very healthy for me and just weren't. Because as I got older, suppressing all that things just made me sicker.
And at one point, things bubbled over. Christy reached out for help and started focusing on feeling better. She was still writing, but instead of keeping it to herself, she tried something different and shared what she was going through with her self-help blogs and books. Christy took it a step further in 2015 when she published a young adult novel called Little Miss Somebody.
So the main character in the book, her name is Nikki. She's 14 years old and she has been displaced from Washington. She goes back to St. Louis with her mom and just kind of like dropped in, like in culture, which is a shock for her.
Christy drew on her personal experiences and her journals to create the world in the book. Christy's mom struggled with alcoholism. So did Nikki's. Christy never really had a relationship with her father. Nikki tries to seek hers out. It felt cathartic to get her experience out into the world. But remember, you're not supposed to talk about your problems with anybody. So this was also terrifying.
This book is absolutely a representation of so many of the families that are happening in Black culture with, you know, parents who are struggling to make it in poverty and different things that are happening, especially in inner cities, and the young women who kind of get lost.
She didn't want any more young women of color to slip through the cracks. She created an organization in 2018 called Brown Girls Write. Christy holds workshops for older women and guides them through the process of telling their stories. She also organizes an after-school program in several high schools around the region, including Mount Rainier High School in Des Moines. There are 14 girls in the group, and they've been meeting for the last 8 weeks. Christy has the girls adjust the desks so they can form a horseshoe, with her standing at the front. Fried chicken and mashed potatoes are sitting in a corner of the room. She's found that feeding these girls is one way to keep them coming back every week.
All right, you guys, get your food.
The girls are friendly with each other, swapping stories, bumping each other out of the way to grab pieces of chicken and laughing. They're so relaxed and comfortable. Christy says that took some time.
Oh my gosh, week one, they barely want to say anything. It's like you're pulling teeth to get them, you know, because they don't know me. You know, they don't know, a lot of these young women don't even know each other. So, you know, it's that whole piece of, I don't want people to know my business. But like the next couple of weeks, it was just, they had a whole lot to say.
For the final lesson, Christy's telling them to flex their emotional intelligence muscles they've been gaining the last 2 months. Don't judge others and try hard not to act out in anger.
How many of you guys, when people are telling you something, you're thinking about your comeback?
Oh, that's me right there.
I'll be like, huh? Thinking about your comeback, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're practicing active listening, you're actually in the moment with them while they're talking.
By the end of the class, they don't want to leave. They're talking about how they'll probably wind up back in that same classroom the following Monday, waiting outside before realizing there aren't any more meetings this year. Christy says she wishes she could be spending all her time doing this, but it's just not possible.
But it also makes me feel good in a way. If that sounds weird, I don't mean it to. Meaning that at least I'm one person that can help. Like, I know that it's a small group, but it's a start. Because those young women will tell someone else about their experiences. And the things that they're learning, they'll also be able to teach someone else.
And when you talk to these girls, she's onto something. They've been feeling a change, and they aren't the only ones to notice. When I brought Christy into the studio to talk with me after the visit to the school, I wanted to play parts of the interviews I did with her students. Kalia Balak is a freshman at Mount Rainier, and I asked her if anyone in her family had seen a difference in her behavior since attending these workshops. She said, yeah, actually, her dad had mentioned something.
He's the only one I would tell my problems to, and like, it was just, he said it literally mentioned like 2 days ago, he was like, your attitude changed, because I used to be like, I get hostile easy. And then like, he was like asking me how, what happened. And I told him about the group and stuff.
Hearing from Kalia and knowing that her dad noticed this change, how does that make you feel as you hear what she's saying?
You know what? It actually puts perspective, because when I first started, it's not that she was standoffish. It was just kind of like she was like spectating. And as the group progressed, she would greet me all the time and hug me. So it puts perspective to that.
And then I want to play one more from Erica McMorris, who's a freshman. And I asked her what was her big takeaway after the 8 weeks of being in the program.
I feel like the group has helped me understand like that I have to put myself first. And like, yeah, at the end of the day, other people are going to be important, are going to be in my life. But like all I have is myself.
I loved this one so much. Like, I thought mm-hmm. that was a really important thing for a girl that age to understand.
Yes.
That she's first.
Yes.
And that's not bad.
No, we talked a lot about that. You matter. Your story matters. And I told them, I said, I want you to carry this with you into womanhood, because I'll tell you, I work with women too. And I get to see what the broken woman looks like.
Christy wants to break that cultural pressure for these young women and equip them with the tools they need to be stronger emotionally than she was for so many years. And Christy wants them to know they aren't alone. But even if her preventative measures don't always stick, she'll be there to pick them up and help them bounce back.
That story from KNKX's Ariel Van Cleve. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Ariel Van Cleve, Aaron Hennessy, and Kari Ploeg. Our executive producer is Matt Martinez. We featured music from Blue Dot Sessions. You can find our 100% free podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you shop for audio. And we care about what you think. Send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org or find us on Facebook. We'll be back next week to talk toilets. So many toilet stories. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.